This is the first Sunday of Lent, and we're embarking on a journey together, not only through these 40 days of the season of Lent, but also through a series of reflections in our sermons and responses to the sermons about who God is, or maybe a better way to put it is who God is not. And I'm drawing an inspiration from, this is actually not by Meister Eckhart, but it's about him. It's called The Way of Paradox. Spiritual life is taught by Meister Eckhart. He was a 13th century monastic in Germany and spiritual writer, and maybe one of the most influential mystics on the Lutheran tradition. He and his tradition ended up influencing Martin Luther in some interesting ways. And he has a famous line, which is behind, in a sense, the whole sermon series that we're going to travel together about who God is not. And his prayer that he prayed is, "I pray, God, that you would rid me of God." And he was actually brought on trial for heresy later in his life because he said things like that were confusing to people. But what he was after, in a sense, was a search for authentic and deeply experiential connection with God, and that required stripping away of things that are in between, that get in the way of that true connection to God. And he also thought at the very same time that journey meant a journey to experience your authentic and most deep self, which meant stripping away aspects of what gets in the way of us truly experiencing ourselves. So the journey to God is at the very same time a journey to the self and to understanding both together. And I was just, as I was reflecting on this basic idea of taking away, in a sense, all the stuff that gets in the way of us experiencing ourselves and God, I was thinking about the Jewish understanding of God, which is present in God's self-revelation, I don't know the Hebrew. Do you want to say the Hebrew?
Eyer, Asha, Eyer.
Mm-hmm. Which is translated different ways, but a common way to translate it is "I am who I am," or "I am who I am becoming." There's a number of different ways to translate it, but there was a reticence, there still is a reticence in Judaism to say the name of God, and the use of the word Lord is a way to say God without using the name of God. And that one of the Ten Commandments is about making images of God. So there's this almost like built-in expectation that we can't like say God's name and have it be exactly correct, even though we have lots of analogies that help us understand God, and we can't picture God accurately because God isn't fundamentally picturable in that way. And I was thinking about how important that claim is, that God's identity is because God is. Like, there's this fundamental claim that God's identity is that God is. And then we're made in the image of God, so our fundamental identity rests in the fact that we are, not that we do any particular thing. And so our fundamental identity as children of God, as beloved, takes seriously, I think, the beauty of how diverse we are, whether we're queer or straight, whether we're black or brown, or like from European descent. Like, I keep thinking, how do I not say white? Because I think it's a challenge to begin to, in a sense, dismantle racism by even refusing the categorization of white, which is constructed simply as a hierarchical construction of privilege. People who believe themselves to be white. people with different abilities, like whoever you are, your identity is fundamentally because you are in the image of God, who is. That's really powerful. And so we don't have to do anything at all to be God's beloved. And I think Jesus in this text, which we'll get to in a minute, is inviting a certain kind of stripping away of misconceptions of what it is to be made in God's image, who God is, who we're called to be as followers of God. And I want to do it through thinking about imagery. It's a way into thinking about the idea of God being a white male, which is what I'm interested in pushing back on, that God is not a white male. And so I wanted to first start with just an image that was on the wall in my dining room when I was growing up. And you can see the picture. It's of an old man with white hair and a white beard, and his hands folded prayerfully, and he's leaning into his elbows. He's got a bowl of soup and a loaf of bread on the table with him. His glasses are folded on a big book, which, you know, probably is a Bible. And this was just on the wall next to where our family dining room table was. And it was taken by Eric Ekstrom in Bovee, Minnesota, in a small mining town in rural Minnesota in about 1920. And the guy, Charles Wilden, no one really knows much about. He was a peddler of some sort. And he came into the photography studio and posed for this picture, which then became iconic and became really famous. It sold millions and millions of copies. And I just thought it was like, I don't know what I thought of it when I was a kid, but I've been reflecting on what it, like how it functioned, how that image functioned in our household. And you notice there's no family in the picture. It's just a single white man. And I thought how, you know, it functioned to underscore my dad's authority as head of the household, which he absolutely claimed. And one of the dynamics was we would always eat dinner together, and my dad was always like the judge of if dinner was good or not. And it was just a dynamic of like him claiming his authority in the house. He would come home from work. His newspaper was supposed to be by his recliner so he could sit in. And I didn't think of that painting in that way, but it functions that way, to sort of here's the pious white male who we look up to on the wall. And it was reinforced at church too. I had a white male pastor all the way through growing up. I didn't have a female pastor till I got to college. And so that in and of itself, like there are white men, obviously, that can't just be problematic, but it's problematic, especially because of the way in which social systems develop that privileged and with violent protection, the power of white men. And I was thinking particularly about the way in which European expansion from the 1500s on brought European power, Christianity, a sense of superiority, a desire for extraction of materials all over the world. And in order for them to do that and to claim the land and to claim the labor of the people that they discovered without regard for them, they had to create a system in which they were described as the pinnacle of humanity. And they did. And it was what led to the creation of racial hierarchization, where white is the top, and it justifies in its construction this taking, this theft. So then, in that context, when you have this privileging of images of white males, then it changes the power an image. And so images both can reinforce those power structures of society that we live in and that shape us, and they can subvert them too. That's one of the beautiful things about art. And so I put two on your sheet, two pictures of the Visitation. One is from about the beginning of this age of exploration, or quote, age of discovery in Europe. It's from a Dutch painter in the mid-1400s, and it's of this very serene, very pale European couple of ladies depicting Mary pregnant with Jesus and Elizabeth pregnant with John the Baptist, meeting in this famous story in Luke's gospel. And the power of that depiction and its authority to describe, like, Mary and Elizabeth, you know, surely did not look like that. But the power of that to depict that moment is underscored simply because of the social system of privileging white European identity. And so then it necessarily means that this other one by Romare Bearden, who was an African-American artist in Harlem, depicting the Visitation, is a subversion. It's a disruption of the imagery that supports the dominant. And it's just been repurchased by MoMA. And so on the subway system around town, you can see this picture that I included here being displayed, drawing attention to it and inviting people to come see it. So in that subversion that Romare Bearden is doing, he's saying, no, we too are made in the image of God. There's a necessity of assertion of agency because the social, one of the most damaging things about this social structure is that it says all these people are not in the image of God. Only white people are, and that's why white people could take their land and their lives and their labor. So this reassertion actually not only claims the identity and value of the people who've been left out, but it actually offers the opportunity to recover the true humanity of the people who've been deemed white. So this whole system of social power and images, I think, is at its most problematic when it's about imaging God. And so I included this super famous picture of God at the Sistine Chapel that Michelangelo painted in the early 1500s. I could have included George Burns, because of course he's just as iconic as Michelangelo, probably, as God. But, you know, we talked earlier about how God can't be imaged and can't be named, and how powerful that is. And then what we've done is we've gendered and racialized God in a way that makes God this old white man with a gray beard. And it's important where it is. Has anyone been to the Sistine Chapel? Yeah, a few of you. So you know it's in the palace of the Pope. It's the chapel, the apostolic chapel in the palace of the Pope. I mean, that in and of itself, that the sort of vicar of Christ would have a palace, is an interesting conception. You have to just stop and take that one in. And it's a complexity I want to hold on to. Like, Michelangelo was a supremely talented artist, and the Sistine Chapel is amazing. And this depiction of God's creation of Adam is also beautiful. So it's not the art in and of itself, but the way it plays a role in social structures which reinforce hierarchies of power and which are included in disempowering and demeaning whole categories of other people. And it's why, for example, it's so disruptive when someone does something like the Krista crucifix, that the artist's name is Edwina Sandy. And it was originally, like 25 years ago, displayed in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and created such an outcry that they removed it. You know what I'm talking about? It's a bronze cast of a female body crucified on the cross. And the piece is called Christa. So it's Christ, but a feminine, very visibly naked feminine body crucified on the cross. And her point was, Jesus represents, the Christ represents the fullness of humanity and saves the fullness of humanity. And so we have to be able to see this saving body in a multiplicity of ways. And that means not just as male. 25 years later, in 2016, they brought it back to Cathedral of St. John the Divine and said, society has changed and we have changed and we want to build an exhibit around it and say, no, this actually is important to have a multiplicity of images that help us to know and understand all of ourselves as in God's image. So when we take all of this back into this text, one way to read this text is a contestation about what it is to be powerful and what it is to, in a sense, in Jesus' case, be God's anointed, be the Christ, the Messiah, to be the one that in his baptism is claimed as my beloved child, with whom I'm well pleased. Why? Like, what is he embodying that makes God well pleased? And the temptations of the devil all seem like articulations of power that are familiar, that are in a sense abuses of power, that are ways of self-aggrandizing with power. Mm. And it's so pervasive. Like, we're completely familiar with that, with the would-be Orange King of America, who seems to constantly want to use self-aggrandizing modes of power. It's very present in our life today. And in each moment, Jesus refuses it by quoting the Psalms and saying, no, not that way. In a sense, he's like doing subversive art in response to the devil's propositions and opening up a way to say to us, God is not that. And Jesus, I think, does this a lot in his debates with people, both through his actions and his words. God is not that. Being made in the image of God is not that. It's not this kind of power. It's not this kind of piety. It's not this kind of superiority. So I like to think what Jesus was aiming at is actually in alignment with what Mary Daly was after in this really famous feminist theology book, Beyond God the Father, which was one of the first really aggressive theological critiques in the contemporary 20th century feminist movement against patriarchy and against patriarchal language for God. And the thing that she says is at the heart of her challenge, and I'm connecting it to what I think is at the heart of Jesus' challenge, is this idea that we're really trying to move beyond deconstruction, beyond the no to a yes. And I think in this whole Lenten series, we're aiming to move beyond the no, God is not, to the yes, what God is. And she says, what she's aiming for is the emergence of whole human beings, not just whole women, whole human beings. And I think in that sense, it takes us back to the beginning and Meister Eckhart's claim that in searching for our whole full selves, we find this whole present loving God. And so I want to close by adapting Meister Eckhart's prayer for tonight. Dearly beloved, I pray, God, that you rid me of a white male God. Amen.
Amen. Amen.